I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Last year, when the legendary radio personality Frosty Force joined me on this program, we reflected on what made his show as successful as it was. In this part of the world, it was a highly rated show that everyone listened to and was a vital part in what made radio station CKNW such a leader in this market. One of the regular features on the show, Rick Forchuk, joins me now. The veteran movie and media critic was a daily feature on CKNW and remains so, appearing Sunday mornings with Jill Bennett. He also appears twice a morning on CFAX in Victoria weekdays and three times a week on Edmonton CHED and CHQR in Calgary. His association with CKNW goes back to 1986, and in the last 30 years, he's been on air at CJOR here in Vancouver, as well as CBC Radio and Television, and was the resident movie and television critic on the CBC program Midday. His career in print began with the Southern Chain and then the Edmonton Sun, Winnipeg Sun, and Ottawa Sun. He was the television columnist with the Victoria Times columnist as well and wrote the cover stories for TV Week magazine. I've invited Rick on today to reflect on his career in the media, which he conducts with an equally successful career in insurance. I'll also ask Rick about the films nominated for the upcoming Academy Awards, as well as the movies out that he likes and recommends. Visit rickspicks.ca for all of his movie picks, films out in theaters as well as on DVD or streaming. He watches a lot of stuff. His Twitter handle is at R4Chuck. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Rick Forchuk. Mr. Forchuk, good morning.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So
pleasure to be anywhere at this stage of my life.
I understand you're hanging out with the president.
Yeah, I was just down the road a little bit from Air Force One. I spend a good part of the winters these days in the Palm Desert area, and President Obama flew in several days ago, and his plane was parked for about 4 days at the end of the runway at the Palm Springs Airport. Lots of security, and you know, no matter what your politics, when you see that aircraft, the size of it, the kind of awesomeness of it all, you can't help but say, "Wow, that's a world class event. That's really something."
Yeah, it's a beautiful. I mean, the blue is so vivid, and you don't see that anywhere else. The paint of the painted blue or whatever on that plane, it's just a majestic aircraft, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. By the way, Rick, how many movies do you see a week?
Well, it depends how many come out a week, Joe. That's really what it comes down to. Most movies are released on Friday, and if there are three released, then I'll see three. If there are five released, I'll see five, and if there's only one, that's what I'll see. And then I balance that off with revisiting favorites or movies that I haven't seen in a long time, or when something comes up either on Show Me or Netflix or Crave TV, I keep my eye on that as well. And so I would say in the course of a normal week, average, probably watch 10 movies a week.
Wow. And you don't go to those early morning screeners that the critics go to, or do you?
I do not, and I'll tell you why. There was a time in my life some years ago where I did that, and just so that listeners understand that there are each week, usually on Tuesday, screenings of the week's movies for the reviewers and for the critics so that they can see these, they can write about them, and then the day that the movie opens or the day before, their review is in the paper or online or on the radio. I did that for a time, and what I found very quickly was nothing is worse than watching a movie with a bunch of people who think they're smarter than the people who made the movie. And they're so pretentious, and I don't mean that personally for any one individual, but they're always trying to outdo one another with the best turn of phrase or to demonstrate how smart they really are. And what I found quite quickly was the best place to get a real good sense of what a movie's like is sitting in the theater with regular people and then following them out into the washroom or into the lobby afterwards and just listening to what they say. So my wife Betty and I do that weekly, and we've done it religiously for many, many years. She goes one way and I go the other once we leave the movie. Then we compare notes, and that helps me to formulate my review. And because Betty and I have been doing this together for so long, she's affectionately known as Betty Boop. That was her nickname all through high school, which was quite a few years ago. I'm to the point now where I can just ask her when a movie's done, what did I think? And she'll tell me what I thought, and then I'll know. So, but to answer your question, no, I don't go and watch with the other reviewers.
You must have a lot of scene points then.
I have a lot of scene points. You bet I have. Yeah. I get a lot of free popcorn and a lot of free movies, lots and lots of those.
And in terms of DVDs, do you have a big DVD collection?
I do. It's not as big today as it was when it was growing,
yeah.
Because now it's so much easier to download something on iTunes and keep it in the cloud or whatever way you want to get your movies. But I probably have 600 or 700 DVDs. Worse, though, Joe, much worse than that, I still have boxes and boxes of movies on VHS tape. Mm. And they're hopeless. They're useless. The quality is terrible, and I can't part with them. So after I die, somebody will be responsible for disposing of all of these things.
That's the other thing, too, as we move to these new formats, and you know, with each year technology changes, a lot of the old stuff, say, that was available on VHS never went on DVD, and then I'm assuming that a lot of the stuff that came out on DVD in the early years, in the last 15 years or so, that stuff's not getting transferred over to either Blu-ray, or you could find that either streaming as well.
Well, that's very true. It's very true. It's very much like the book publishing business, where over the years, when books go in and out of print, some come back and some don't. When the technology was available, I began moving all of my favorite VHS movies onto DVD and then into my iTunes library so that I have a permanent record. But frankly, I don't watch too many of those anymore, because since the advent of HD and Blu-ray, it's hard to watch analog. And, you know, you just know that there's a much better picture out there, and you're not getting it. So it's hard to watch analog today, for me at least. And I'm very much a guy who loves the clarity of a good Blu-ray or a great HD movie or some of the new technologies that's used in the big screens.
Yeah. So I see your picks on your website, rickspicks.ca, and you just seem to watch everything. So how do you manage to sit through stuff that you probably wouldn't like?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and my wife Betty and I have this discussion a lot, because she will often say, look, if you're going to be in this business, you have to watch everything. And I say, but I don't like that. I don't want to watch that movie. It's got Will Ferrell in it. Please don't make me do this. So I have to steel myself, and I do watch, but there are times when it's very difficult. And I'll tell you what those times are. I'm not a big fan of the, and first of all, let me backtrack a bit. Seth Rogen, as a Vancouver guy, has built an incredible career. I think what he's done as an actor, as a writer, as a producer, is phenomenal. But I don't like his stuff, because I don't like the stoner, sexually oriented stuff that a lot of these kinds of performers do. So I watch it, but I watch it with some reluctance, because it's kind of all the same. Not much new happens there, and it all seems to be kind of like being back in grade 8 or 9 and seeing who could outgross the next person. So those kinds of films are hard for me to sit through, but I like most everything. I like a good romantic comedy, and I love great action and adventure, and science fiction is my watchword. So we just kind of watch everything, and my wife particularly will prompt me to watch something I wouldn't normally see, and she'll say, look, it's time. You know, this week that we watched an art film, so we'll watch something artsy. For example, not that it's so artsy, but the movie Brooklyn, which is up for an Academy Award, I was, you know, not jumping up and down to see that film. And Betty really strongly suggested, we should see this. And I knew we would sooner or later, but we went sooner, and I'm so glad. It was such a phenomenal movie, although not a film I would normally pick up and just watch for recreational purposes, Joe.
Yeah, see, that's something that I haven't seen, and I really want to see.
Yeah, beautiful movie.
Yeah.
Beautifully done. Saoirse Ronan has an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. Well-deserved. I hope she wins. I'm not sure she will, but I hope she wins. She just does a great job in this movie.
And of the films nominated for Best Picture, I guess you've seen all those, have you?
Yes, I have. I've seen them all.
And I guess the three that are emerging in terms of what I read and say online on Variety or The Hollywood Reporter that will that are the front runners, I guess, are the Revenant, The Big Short, and Spotlight.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah,
I think that's true, and I'm guessing, and I hate making predictions because all you can do is lose with that. But I'm thinking The Revenant is going to get Best Picture, and I think it should. But it could go to The Big Short. It could go to Bridge of Spies. It could go to Brooklyn. I'm not sure it should go to Mad Max. But Spotlight, those are all great films. So what you really have to do is try to get inside the heads of the Academy and figure out how they vote, because they're a highly political bunch. And as we know from this these past Oscars, they're all older white males predominantly, and they see things a little bit differently. Movies such as The Big Short and Spotlight, because they are independent films or relatively small budget and heavy on good, strong writing, tend to be favored by them more than something like The Revenant, which is really an action picture, something like The Martian, which is an action picture. But you never know. Anything can happen with the Oscars. So I love to talk about the movies and the performers. I'm very reluctant to make predictions because, as I said, A, all you can ever do is lose, and B, nobody really knows what thinking goes into making these choices. Now, I'll give you an example. I suspect that Leo DiCaprio will get Best Actor for The Revenant.
Right.
Is it his best work? I don't think so. I think it's very good work, but not necessarily his best. But the Academy passed him over two or three times for some of his great work. So I think this is going to be one of those times when he'll get Best Actor, not just for The Revenant, but for his body of work. And that would be fair. I'd be happy with that.
Yeah. You realize just how political it is, because I go back to the year that Lincoln was nominated, which everyone thought was the best film of the year.
Yeah.
And then Argo won it. And a lot of people thought, well, Argo won it because it had the momentum going into the voting, and because Ben Affleck had been snubbed for Best Director.
Exactly.
And I think if he had been nominated for Best Director, I don't think the film would have been nominated, because I think they gave him the Best Picture because it was a consolation prize, say.
Joe, I agree with you. I think you've got that exactly right. I think that's how that came down.
Yeah. Now, so in the introduction, I listed off this career that you've had over the years and all of the gigs, but the years of association with Frosty Forrest on CKNW, those were the best?
Those were my best years in media, without question. I've done a lot of things over a lot of years, but working with Frosty, for me, was absolutely the high point of my media career. He is an amazing person. He is so smart. He is so clever. And all of that, plus, he's just a guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Now, I'm pleased to say he's a neighbor, and we've been friends for years. And I really, really respect and admire him.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to him growing up, and then, you know, and when I talked to him last year, I mean, sitting here at my desk, I mean, I just realized I didn't realize it then, but I mean, I just you could tell just what a genius he is.
Yeah, he doesn't like to be called Frosty.
No.
Today, his name is Brian, and that's his name. Frosty's a character he created, and it was a character he created, he built, and he put together over a great period of time. And I was always amazed at how people would completely buy into that. For example, he would, when he would take a vacation, he would perhaps go to Hawaii or do other vacation-like things that other people did. But what he would say he was going to do is he's going to put some new skirting around the double wide in the trailer park in Newton, because a family of raccoons under there have built another nest. So that's what he's going to be spending his vacation doing. And people would bump into me on the street and they'd say, hey, how's Frosty doing with the raccoons? And they totally believe that that's exactly what he was, because that's the persona he created. He's an amazing man. I quite agree with you. He's a highlight, a highlight, and a highlight.
So you were on with him, I guess, twice a day, was that right?
Yes, that's right, twice every morning.
And so you did the segment that I just enjoyed and never missed was Media Buzz, and that was on at 7:15, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and then you also did, I guess, more showbiz stuff earlier in the morning?
Yeah, we called it Media Biz. Well, he called it that. That was Frosty's invention. He said, you know, let's do this twice a morning. Mm-hmm. First off, let's do Media Biz, which is going to be what's on television, what's at the movies, what's going on. And then let's do Media Buzz, which has a better focus on local stuff.
Yeah.
And that's something, Joe, that really I think is missing completely from most local media today, particularly radio, and that is that nobody talks about other people the way Frosty used to. Now, he got us all into a lot of trouble. Phil Reimer, who worked on that program as well, and who's a good friend and has been for many years, got into heaps of trouble. I got into heaps of trouble, and we didn't even do anything. But it was because of the way Frosty would set things up. And I'll give you an example. There was a time when the then Jennifer Mather, who was at BCTV doing weekend news and weather, was seen at a hockey game in, I think, Toronto, but I could be wrong about the city. But it was a full network hockey game, and there she was with Brian Burke. Now, this was long before they actually became a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So one morning on the air, from out of nowhere, Frosty, in his own inimitable fashion, says, Rick Forchuk, you're telling me off the air about that fella Berkey and his girlfriend. What did you think about all of that? Well, now we're into it, and I wasn't telling him anything off the air. But he would love to set the cat amongst the pigeons. And then, because he never went anywhere, he was always something of a hermit, a recluse.
Yeah.
But I went lots of places. I find myself in a play down at the Waterfront Theater, and Jennifer Mather accosts me and says, I didn't hear what you said on the radio, but I heard from somebody who heard from somebody that it was not very nice. Why did you do that to me? I thought you were a good guy. And I'm trying to say, I didn't do anything. It was all show business. But, you know, you get caught in those things. Phil Reimer got into some big trouble with the Archdiocese of the Roman Catholic Church because of something that he didn't ever say, but Frosty just set it up in such a fashion that he'd say, well, Phil Reimer, you told me off the air about this situation with that nun. Tell me a little bit more about that. And he would just catch us cold. He would do it with everybody. And he was phenomenal, just a phenomenal character.
And so I mentioned to you on these emails that we batted about as we arranged this chat today about how I would like to have sort of the media reporting criticism that you did on the Frosty Show, because I think we need that in our discourse today.
Well, I think we do, and that's the big thing, as I said, that's missing. Frosty was very, very good at all of that. He would watch for things like this. He'd call me. He'd call me in the middle of the afternoon after he'd had his nap, mm-hmm. and he'd say, I was just watching my tape recording of the morning news on Global. Did you notice that so-and-so, fill in the name of female news anchor here, didn't have her wedding ring on today? And I'd say, well, I didn't see the show. He said, well, take a look. It's missing. I can even see the white mark. I think we should talk about that. I think she's in trouble. I think there's something going on. And you know what? He was invariably right. And whether that's anybody's business or not doesn't really matter. These are local people that come into our homes every day, and part of the price of admission is you make yourself a bit of a target. And Frosty was very, very good at spotting talent, and equally good at spotting people who were a little bit too full of themselves and really didn't deserve to be where they were. And I agree, it's not around much in today's media, and I'm sorry for that, but you have to have very special people to be able to get away with it. Because with Frosty, he knew he'd never bump into anybody because he didn't go anyplace. He was never in any fear. It was all the rest of us that worked with him, Joy Metcalf, Phil Reimer, Norm Groman, all the rest of us were out there in the world, and we were the ones being accosted for his behavior. And you know what? We loved it.
So was it then your reports or the banter with Frosty, was that influential in terms of what got on the air in terms of whether it's the personalities or the sort of news that we saw on television in this market?
Well, I think it was. Now, that might be a little presumptuous, but I truly think, and I'll give you an example, and that would be Tamara Taggart. When she started out doing weather on, I think, CTV locally, mm-hmm. she was terrible. And Frosty and I talked about that regularly. In fact, I remember one day saying, you know, I watched her do the weather last night, and I started counting the ums. She said 122 times. And we talked about that on the air. She actually was hurt by it, first of all, but secondly, took it to heart, and she and her producers and her people really went to work on repackaging herself and really learning how to do things. She went from being a real rookie to being a very, very polished broadcaster, extremely polished and very professional. And she sits in the big anchor chair today. So clearly, she has done some things well. And Frosty might say, you know what, I had a little bit to do with that. And I think he did. And she wouldn't be the only one. She's the first that comes to mind. But for sure, I think he's had an influence on those kinds of people because they live in fear for what he might say because he is so right. He's so insightful and so right.
The other thing that you mentioned, and I guess it's indicative of this market, and it's just how competitive it is and how important it is for all these stations in terms of their news product, because that's what people watch then and now. I mean, the market shrunk a little bit, but I mean, it's still, they invest a lot of money in those newscasts at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, you're right, Joe, and I've lived in a number of other cities across Canada, and I travel a great deal on business, have for many, many years, so I'm in Montreal or Toronto or Edmonton or Calgary or Winnipeg, sometimes several times in a month, and as I watch the local television news there and get the sense of what's happening in media, never is it the way it is here on the Lower Mainland. Here on the Lower Mainland, we know all of our media people. They are our friends or our enemies. We love them or we hate them, but we talk about them. We live and breathe them. I don't get that sense anyplace else. When Wayne Cox retired from Global as the weatherman there, people were genuinely mortified. I mean, they cried real tears because Wayne is one of the most amiable and nice guys that ever got involved in media. And to lose him as a friend, to lose somebody like that, was horrible. I don't see that happen in any other Canadian market. And you could tell that story about a lot of different people. He comes to mind specifically because he is so loved. And yes, he still does some commercials, and we get to see him a little bit, but it's not the same as seeing Wayne's weather window and seeing what kind of a Hawaiian shirt he's wearing, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an interesting market here. It's a fabulous market.
Yeah, and because you guys, you and Frosty aren't on the air talking about what's happening in the news business, we don't know whether he left because he was actually going to spend more time with his family, or the reality of what was happening at that television station at the time, and television stations like it, in terms of just, you know, the money and the revenue that was being generated and whatever his salary was.
Well, yeah, and there's always a story behind the story. Yeah. Now, I know the story behind Wayne. I wouldn't tell it without him saying, yeah, let's talk about that, right, and doing it with him. It's not a sordid story at all. He was very much in control of what he chose to do. But many, many, many times there is a plot, a conspiracy, a movement to get rid of somebody because they're too old or too tall or too blonde or too short or too something. And often the people in media that make these kinds of decisions are those that Frosty used to refer to as those pinheads from Carpet City. And they were pinheads, and they didn't know the business very much. They were accountants, and they were folks that were making decisions based on their knowledge of nothing. So I'm right up there with him and the pinheads. I totally agree with him.
What do you watch now in terms of local news, and who do you like, and conversely, who don't you like?
Well, I watch it all, because I just make it my business to. I didn't think I would ever get to like Chris Galis, but I really do like Chris Galis on Global. I've come to really appreciate him, and I wasn't sure I was ever going to really get comfortable with the changes at CTV with Mike Colleen and Tamara, but I find that they're a very, very workable team. They do very, very well. And as we go through all of that, I find that every one of them, every one of these broadcast teams, brings something to the table that's a little different, a little unique. Global still owns the marketplace here, and so they should. They go back to the days when BCTV was just the giant, and they still do very, very well. A lot of people have come and a lot of people have gone. I must say that I love Squire Barnes. I have loved Squire Barnes' work ever since I listened to him on CKO All News FM Radio, which goes back a long way. That network is long gone, but Squire persists, and he's a very unique guy, does a nice job at the sports. I quite like him.
Yeah, I'm like you. I watch everything, but the one that I watch live, I guess, at 6 o'clock is the CBC's broadcast, because I can get that online.
Well, you're the guy who's watching the TV. You're the one.
They got a great team there, too. I mean, the reporters are, you know, they have sort of reporters my age, you know, I'm 33, so in their early 30s and the sort. And then they have, you know, senior reporters, people like Eric Rankin and Bell Puri.
Yes.
But it's I mean, we are well served in this market, don't you think?
We are. And you know what? I too bad I didn't mention the CBC, because it, too, was a powerhouse at one time. You know, Bill Good on the anchor desk with Cecilia Walters, Phil Reimer doing the weather. And as things progressed and changed in the CBC, it changed as well. I love Ian Hannah-Mansing. I love his work. And a lot of the people whose names you mentioned are first class. And yet, CBC is many people's third or fourth or fifth choice. And that's too bad. Yeah. I agree with you. They have a great product.
Yeah.
And I love the long form of journalism that they do. Rather than going for the quick soundbite with very little information, but some sensationalism attached, they get into the story, and that I really appreciate.
So we talked about your viewing habits in terms of movies and the sort. So where do you think news will be, because of all these changing technologies, say 5-10 years down the line? I mean, can these legacy media organizations and print and broadcast, I mean, will they survive?
Well, you know, if I really knew the answer to that, I'd be making way too much money to be talking to you right now. So I don't know, but certainly we can see with the advent of online opportunities. Actual television viewing is dropping off in every market all across North America. So as alternative methods become available, and as younger people, millennials, begin to really become a force, an impact in the marketplace, all of these businesses are going to have to pull up their socks and figure out what to do next, because you're right, it's very expensive to run a newsroom like that of the CBC or Global or CTV. It costs a lot of money, and to get good people, you have to pay them well. And it's not unlike morning radio. There was a time right across Canada, all over North America for that matter, but right across Canada, where if you had a morning gig in a big market radio station, that was a license to print money. Today, not so much. I mean, people do well, but they don't make the kind of money relative to the economy that they once did when they were just powerhouses. That also is true of news. You know, the days when Tony Parsons sat in the anchor chair at BCTV and later Global, he was the man. He was an icon, and he had incredible influence, and now he's not there. Now, he's older. He's well into his 70s and is doing a lot of other interesting things, but time marches on. The world passes us by if we did keep running. So I would not want to be a guy responsible for making those kind of decisions in media today. We see that daily newspapers are in terrible, terrible trouble. That's a business that was near and dear to my heart for many years, and I just cry when I think of what's become of it all. But something always moves in to take over, because nature abhors a vacuum. And something, whether it's the internet or whether it's something we haven't thought about yet, Joe, something will step in and it'll be the next big thing.
Yeah, Kevin Newman, when I had him on the program, I guess in the fall when his book came out, he and his son wrote a book, he said that, and this surprised me, that a lot of the people that we see on television nowadays, anchors even, don't break into six figures. And you know, you contrast that, I mean, talking to Frosty, you know, we all know that he made a healthy living. I had Bill Good in front of me here a few months ago, and you know, he made a good living. People like me who grew up watching these guys, listening to Frosty, watching Bill Good, watching Tony Parsons, who thought of going into the business, kind of expected that was what was going to happen. And then you hear from Newman that it's not. I mean, I guess that's why a lot of journalists and good journalists go to PR and work for the government or stuff like that.
Well, it's true, because the money isn't where it used to be. I worked with Kevin Newman for a couple of years on Midday. Mm-hmm. You mentioned CBC's Midday, and he was one of the anchors there at one point, and stayed in touch with him over the years. And he had a very, very strong career in New York with ABC and made big money. He really made big money. Chris Galis was in New York City making big money as a local news anchor. There, a local news anchor could make $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year or more. All of those days are gone. And you're right, it's sad, but those days are gone. And is it a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's just a thing. And, you know, the world passes you by if you don't keep moving. And something always comes up to fill in the blanks. Maybe we can get Frosty back on the air.
Oh, and that'd be great. Oh, that'd be great. I mean, when I talked to him last year, I mean, he's as sharp as ever.
Oh, he is. He is just as sharp as a tack.
So one wonders, and if they're paying cheaper prices for the talent, does the product that we get as the news consumer, as the viewer, is that less than it would have been if we were getting, you know, these marquee names from way back?
Well, I don't think so, Joe, and I'll tell you why. Because in every market, and Vancouver is no exception, in every market there are people, and you might be one of them, and I might have been one of them, who do this kind of work because they love it so much they would do it for nothing. And eventually somebody comes along and taps them on the shoulder and says, hey, we'd like to pay you to do that. And you think, well, I don't want them to ever know I do it for nothing because I love it so much. So you start to get a paying gig out of it. That's, I think, the new model. And that is, do something else. Do what you do. Do it well. Build a profile. Never, ever stop learning. Never stop adding to your education. And never stop looking for the opportunity to be able to get paid for what you do. Because typically, people who know a lot about something get paid well for that knowledge. Whether it's a comic book collector or whether it's television trivia, somewhere out there is a commercial application for that. And as I say, maybe that's the next model. Maybe this will be a model of young people who have grown up smart and focused and learning one specific aspect of their craft and finding a way to make that pay, that could be.
Yeah, I think we need a generation of media critics, because I just think that it'll make the product better as well.
Well, you're right. I think, I'm trying to remember who said it. Vince Lombardi, that's who it was. Vince Lombardi, the long, long departed coach of the Green Bay Packers, told his players repeatedly, love your competition because it's they who make you good.
Mm.
And that's true in media for sure. Love the critics because in there is some little nub of reality. Now, when I started doing reviews of television and movies in the newspaper business, I had an editor named Dave Billington. He's long dead, and he's a character like a Lou Grant kind of guy. But he gave me a little card, and he said, before you take yourself too seriously about this job I'm giving you, read this card every day, because it is really, truly what you do. And I still have that little card. It's all dog-eared and dirty, but it still sits in my calendar, and it says, critics are people who sit up in the hills until the battle's over, then they come down and they shoot the wounded.
But I never got the sense, though, that you were out to get people when
no.
you were... No, and I think that's what set you apart from a lot of critics.
No, because we want to criticize the work, not the person.
Exactly, yeah. So there are four clips of you on YouTube from your years on the CBC on Midday, and I guess someone's uploaded those. Two of the four talk about Dallas in a substantive form. So I'm assuming that was a show that you liked.
I loved Dallas, but it was also a phenomenon because it was the show in 1978 that returned the cliffhanger ending to television. There had been no cliffhanger endings since the movie serials of the 1940s and 50s, where every kid with a dime could go to the movie on Saturday morning, and they'd get 18 minutes of somebody like Flash Gordon getting into horrible trouble at the end of the clip, and you had to wait till next week to see what would happen. That all went away, but Dallas pulled a huge coup when they had J.R. Ewing shot in the final episode in May of 1978. The ratings went through the roof, and suddenly everybody in television said, holy cow, this is something new, let's do this. And to this very day now, every season enders a cliffhanger, and it gets old after a while. But still, I did love Dallas. I loved it for the trend-setting format that it built. I loved it for the over-the-top characters it made, and I still like that show.
Yeah, we tend to think of it as a soap opera, but I mean, I grew up watching reruns of it, you know, after school, and it was, as you said, a big deal. But beyond that, it was a well-written show.
Yes, it was.
Even when it was bad, it was still better than the alternative, I guess, you know. But you talk about cliffhangers. I mean, the shows nowadays, these one-hour dramas, I mean, they have taken that to a different level where they just start killing people.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
the new thing.
Yeah.
Let's shock the audience by taking a favorite character and let's off them right now.
Yeah.
And that is scary because it does add a new element, because now you know that nothing's sacred.
Yeah.
Anybody can be gone. And, you know, we have The Good Wife, which I think is one of the best written dramas on television today. And it killed off a major character four seasons ago. It killed off two other major characters, didn't kill them off, but it disappeared them.
Yeah.
And now the show itself will disappear at the end of this season, because Juliana Margulies has said, my contract's up, it's been 7 years, I'm not going to do this anymore. And the network, CBS, much to its credit, has said, you know what, let's just wrap it up. Because normally, Joe, the American way with television series is to flog a dead horse. Let's keep this thing going somehow. Let's bring on the sons or the daughters, or let's bring on some distant relative, and let's try to keep it going. I'm glad that, as the British do, CBS in this case has decided with The Good Wife, despite the fact it's a fabulous show, to say, you know what, it's done its best work, it's run its course, let's let it go.
Yeah, the new Good Wife or something like that.
Yeah, know? Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't want that.
Yeah, the Downton Abbey, are you a fan of that?
I am, very much so.
Yeah, see, these are shows that I like, and so that's why I'm asking.
Great
about
characters,
them. Yeah.
Fabulous style. Those kinds of shows are, you know, they're timeless. And that's what I like about period pieces, because they never get old.
Yeah.
You can watch a period piece now or 20 years from now, and it's still great because it was set in the past. It doesn't date itself like a show that's made today and you try and watch it 5 years from now, unless it's Seinfeld, and they had no cell phones. But other than that, Seinfeld is timeless as well. Their writing was so very good that they get away with it even 15 years later.
Rick, I've so much enjoyed our chat today. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but I really appreciate it, and I want to thank you as well for that kind note you sent me after the interview with Brian last year. So thanks so much for your time today.
Well, the pleasure's mine, Joe. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
The website for more, rickspicks.ca. Rick Forchuk joined me on the line from Richmond in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.